cloud and occasional sunshine. And by the afternoon, it'll feel pleasantly warm again in the sunny spells, highs across the UK, generally 19 to 23 Celsius, but 25 again in London. For the weekend, on Saturday, scattered showers for the northern half of the UK, mainly northern England, Northern Ireland and Scotland. Breezier here on Sunday and feeling a bit cooler as a result, still with some showers. Southern half of England and Wales on Saturday mainly dry, then on Sunday it'll brighten up after perhaps a bit of early rain. And that's the weather.
I think there are many advantages to being a born pessimist. I'm never disappointed.
My castaway this week is the psychologist and Nobel Prize winner, Daniel Kahneman.
I'm asking people to think about the vacation and asking them to imagine that at the end of the vacation, the camera will be destroyed and they will get a drug that will make them amnesic. So there will be no memory. Are they still interested in having a vacation?
Daniel Kahneman. Join us on Desert Island Discs tomorrow morning at 9.
And now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week. Philip Hawes's new account celebrates a lifetime's love of the sea and has taken us to Southampton Water, London and Sri Lanka. His travels continue, as do his experiences by and in the water now, in another reading from The Sea Inside.
On the ferry to New Zealand's South Island, I settle on the top deck to drink tea, lazily raising my binoculars, only to see a huge grey shape in the mid-distance. Hundreds, if not thousands, of whales still beach themselves on the shores of New Zealand every year and are regarded as tapu, sacred signs. When a pod of pilot whales stranded on the South Island recently, a Maori elder arrived with his sleeping bag to spend the night with them, in order that they should not die alone. At the end of Queen Charlotte Sound stands the town of Picton, a former whaling port. The ferry inches into dock, and I step out onto the street and walk over to the railway platform. The rackety train leaves on the dot of one, rattling through green valleys studded with vineyards. The last carriage is an open-sided observation car. I feel like a character from the Wild West as I lean out into the wind. We arrive at Kaikoura. This former railway town was once busy processing sheep. Now it advertises its new fortune in a punning sign over the old ticket office, the Whaleway Station. In a bar on the town's main street at what he calls beer time, I meet Bill Morris, who has driven all the way from Dunedin to talk whales. He's tall, in his 20s. His hair stands up in tufts from sleeping in his camper van. We climb into the front seats, with his clothes and guitars piled in the back, and drive down to the headland. At low tide, the plateau of rock is covered with seaweed of every shape and colour, a vivid herbaceous border of bladder wrack and coral-like fans. Bill and I walk out to the water's edge, through swathes of bull kelp laid flat like a felled forest. New Zealand fur seals loll, their flashing eyes daring us to get closer. In just one season in 1824, 80,000 fur seal pelts were taken from South Island. Their numbers remain a fraction of what they once were. Bill shows me a lonely, pink-painted wooden hut with a tin roof. Whale ribs are scattered around its stoop. Its foundations stand on vertebrae. Just as Wales brought its first people here, this country's foundation, as far as the West was concerned, lay in whaling. This tiny cottage was once part of the station established here in 1842 by Robert Fife. He and other whalers took up to 14,000 southern rights each year. To them, the stink of rotting carcasses was the smell of money. By the 1920s, 99% of the southern hemisphere's right whales had been killed. All that remains of the factory is a single fireplace, standing like a wayside shrine on the shore. Inside the cottage, the cabin-like rooms are still covered in Edwardian wallpaper. The low southern sun forces through the windows. It feels like the last house in the world. As Bill and I look across to the ocean from Fife House, the sun is already sinking. Ahead of us, the Kaikoura Canyon plunges more than 6 miles down to the ocean bed, the tail end of the great chasm that marks the meeting of the Pacific and Indo-Asian tectonic plates, an abyss into which whole volcanoes are dragged down by the movements of continental drift. Extensive biomasses have been identified in the canyon, 100 times more than expected in such waters. Massive accumulations of life. And down there also swim the largest cephalopods known to humans, and some unknown to us too, perhaps. The next morning, I get up 3 hours before dawn, pausing to marvel that each encounter with a cetacean seems to demand ever earlier risings. I dress quickly, sling my roll bag over my shoulder, and leave quietly by the back door, stepping out into the night morning, then trudging down the hill to the shore. I walk between yellow pools of streetlights. The narrow park on the other side of the road, overlooking the shore, is decorated with an arbour of whalebone arches. The sea has stopped the roaring I could hear from my bedroom, a low rumbling that sounded like a perpetually arriving train. I fight my imagination, which wants to fill my head with images of what might lie beyond the beach. Reporting for duty in a fluorescent-lit room, I tug on my wetsuit. Half an hour later, I'm tipped off the back of the boat and into the still black ocean, falling through the foaming surf churned up by the propellers. Dark fins describe a wide circle 100 yards away. It's difficult to see what's happening in the half-light, still more so since I'm hanging at sea level, waves slapping at my face. Frantically, I tread water, trying to keep upright. Suddenly, sighting through my misty horizon, they're all around me. I'm in the middle of a superpod of 200 dusky dolphins. I see their shapes, exquisitely airbrushed black and white and pearl grey, swimming beneath me. The fins begin to gather and steer towards me more and more, till I'm in an eddying mass of swooping, diving cetaceans. Everywhere I look, there are dolphins. I'm encircled by them. They shoot from a single source like a shower of meteorites, their 2-meter bodies zipping past in and out of focus. I feel strangely calm. It's hard to believe this is real at all, as if the frenzy were happening somewhere else entirely. As I look down into the water, one animal slips into place at my side, then swims round and round, daring me to keep up. I spiral my body, only more aware of my ineptitude in their environment. Dolphins are breaching right by me, turning somersaults in the air. How about this? Can you do that? I reach out instinctively. They easily evade me. That's not part of the game. Dizzy and elated, I'm about to haul myself back on the boat when the skipper, Al, holds out his open palms, indicating I should stay where I am. Is something wrong? He points over my head. I look round and see dozens of dolphins heading straight at me like a herd of buffalo. For a moment, I think they're going to swim right into me, a ridiculous notion. They, like the whales, register my every move, my every dimension, both inside and out, my density, my temperature, what I am and what I am not. A dolphin sonar, which can fire off 2,000 clicks a second, is able to discern something the thickness of a fingernail from 30 feet away. At the last minute, the animals swerve aside, under my legs, by my side, past my head. Everything is turbulence. The water is alive with clicks, as if a current were being passed through it. I feel the sensual power of their bodies as they race past. but the space between us cannot be closed. Nothing passes in between. There's no connection. As abruptly as they come, they're gone. One dolphin takes two or three last spins around me. Then the waters fall quiet once more. Back on the boat, I crouch, shivering on the prow, to watch the superpod pass by. They've fed through the night and are content to play. One dolphin swims below the bow, carrying a piece of seaweed in its beak. Maori navigators, Tohunga, would appeal to dolphins for assistance in a storm. The Tohunga would pluck a hair from his head and throw it to the Taniwha, or water spirit, as a sign of their need for help. A tradition begun after they saw dolphins presenting seaweed as gifts to one another. That afternoon, I board another boat on the far side of the Kaikoura Peninsula. The mountains that I'd ignored on my arrival, too close and too big to see, assert themselves from the perspective of the sea, monumental mirrors of the underwater canyon. The animals take on a similar scale. The southern royal albatross, the Toroa, with its 9.5-foot wingspan, is, with its wandering cousin, the largest seabird in the world. It is also one of the longest lived. Females have been found still breeding in their 60s. Gliding on enormous wings, one circles the boat, watching us. A blue shark swims by, followed by a pair of blue penguins. Our boat tucks into the gentle swell as we come to a halt and wait. I'm on the upper deck talking to the crew when there's a commotion in the water ahead. Without any warning, the huge blunt head of a sperm whale rises perpendicularly from the waves with its mouth open. I can see its massive canines. And caught between them is a 3-foot-long kingfish. Until now, I thought that all sperm whales fed deep down. Here was a whale eating at the surface. One of the crew points out the traces of the whale's sonar buzzes, much more powerful than the dolphin's clicks, creating localized circular patches, as if a ray gun had been trained through the water. As the whale reappears at full length this time, I can judge its bulk. The distance from its cantered nostril to the back of its skull is enough to indicate its size. Compared to the females I'd seen off the Azores, this bull is massive, at least 50 feet long and perhaps 40 years old. 3 decades ago, it left its family, moving south in search of bigger prey, making itself more handsome and huge and therefore more attractive to a partner. Now it has joined other males, both resident and transitory, to feed on the canyon's rich resources. There is no ignoring this animal. It is in its prime, regnant and supreme. And here too its kind are diminished, in number if not in size. Those resources may now be dwindling, and there are fewer and fewer sperm whales to watch for all the frothed defiance of those that remain. The whale dives, its flukes against the mountains, angling down into the canyon, all of a scale. Our captain passes me a pair of headphones which would look more at home on the New York subway, and I listen to the loud clicks below us. He smiles as he tells me, "We call him Tiaki. It means guardian."
Anthony Carf was reading from The Sea Inside by Philip Hoare. The producer was Duncan Minchell. Tomorrow there's a homecoming of sorts at the same time here on BBC Radio 4.